The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. I'm in my spare room, cheap exercise bike, used once behind me. Barry Glendenning is in a red hoodie. Hey, Barry.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well. I've enjoyed the 15 minutes it takes you to get your computer to work. It's something that is never seen or heard by anyone else, but it gives me tremendous pleasure to see you get irate with an inanimate object.
Well, yeah, and what's happened before is I started shouting and swearing at the inanimate object, oblivious to the fact that you and producer Jonathan could both hear me effing and jeffing loudly. And that was a source of much mirth for you.
Well, there was just a sort of a disembodied voice coming in my ears, just saying, "What feckin' tab? What tab?" And it just made me smile.
I think of all the things I could have said about you, about producer Jonathan, about my dissatisfaction with my professional working conditions in general, I think I dodged a hail of bullets.
We've had some nice feedback. Kevin Fingleton says, "I spent yesterday evening excited about having a new Football Weekly podcast to listen to today until it finally dawned on me that it was still Tuesday." I think, Kevin, you speak for a lot of people having no idea. In fact, the fact I know what days I'm doing Football Weekly actually give me a sense of what day it actually is. The Man and Van says, "I never used to understand why older people love the Archers. You're my Archers now. Thanks for the podcast. I might save them up for a Sunday omnibus this week." That is from David.
I've never actually listened to an episode of the Archers. I know the theme tune. And we, of course, did the Sturmey Archers on our radio show.
Yeah.
As a celebration of the life of our good friend Bradley Wiggins.
I'm saying nothing. Here's a question from Ryan. Says, "Max, tell us about the undercover work. You've seen that thing doing the rounds, Barry, on Twitter. Everyone has to put 5 jobs up and say 5 jobs they did. And I was once an undercover reporter with a bit like, you remember when Homer put a camcorder on his head and a pretend turban to film something? I was working for Inside Out. That sort of 3 surprising stories from your region. And the 3 stories that I did before, they no longer... It was sort of on BBC One after the One show. And I did The Tube is Busy at Rush Hour, Canary Wharf is Bright at Night, and I did You Can Buy Drugs on Camden High Street. And so they put me in...
Some serious scooping going on there, man.
Isn't it? They put me in a shirt with a camera in it, but it was like a tent. You know, it was like sort of League One football kit in the early 90s. And I had to go down Camden High Street and ask people for drugs. But as you well know, Barry, I've never asked anyone for drugs before. So I didn't really know what to say. And I just remember going up to a man and saying, you know, basically, "Have you got any drugs?" And him saying, "Come," he said something like, "Come down this alley, come and have a dib dab, and you'll see if it's all right." And that was when I ran away. That was my short-lived undercover reporter life.
Well, you didn't run away, Max. In journalistic parlance, you made your excuses and left.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Were you tempted to have a little dib dab?
No, never touched it. I'm happy enough, Barry. I don't need anything like that.
I can't imagine you approaching someone on Camden High Street or anywhere else trying to buy drugs without looking like so totally like an undercover reporter. I remember once Donal McIntyre was, you know, the undercover journalist who got a Chelsea tattoo and went over undercover with Chelsea headhunters for 6 months in an effort to prove that football fans like to drink beer and fight with each other. And he did do. But on another occasion, he was wandering around a block of flats in Brixton trying to get a laptop stolen so that he could prove there was crime in Brixton. I think it took about 4 days for someone to stick him up with a knife and take his laptop. I mean, I've lived in Brixton for 11 years and I've never been the victim of any sort of crime that I didn't deserve to be.
That'll do for part one. We will introduce Tarek Banger and Sid Lowe in just a second, and we will look around Europe, find out what is going on. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Joining me and Barry, Sid Lowe on the line from Spain. Hey, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks very much. And Tarek Panja from the New York Times in his house or flat in North London. How are you, Tarek?
Tiny flat in North London. Hello.
Nice to have you both on board. Sid, you're further into lockdown. You're now doing hundreds of keepy-ups, you told me.
Yeah, that's basically, you know, there's just enough space to be able to do keepy-ups out the back door. So I'm doing stupid numbers of keepy-ups.
What's your record? Because, I mean, when you said you were doing, if you didn't get 100, you had to do press-ups, I was quite impressed with... Yeah, I know you've got a good touch. I've seen you play, but that's still 100 is quite a lot of keepy-ups.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the record is from years ago when I actually played, but yesterday I got to 265 at one point. I was quite pleased with that.
Barry, what's your record?
I'd say in my pomp or past my pomp, I'd probably do upwards of 100.
Having seen you kick a ball around TalkSport, I am surprised. Tarek, what's your record?
When I got to double figures the first time, I really celebrated hard, and I never got past that 10, 15 mark. So the celebration kind of a bit muted after that. So well done to Sid and Barry.
Let's crack on then. Let's start with the players and pay cuts. There's a lot of talk about it over here. In Spain, Sid, Real's first team and coaching staff have agreed to take a pay cut. Barca and Atleti have as well. What are the details of those, and is it La Liga wide?
No, it's not La Liga wide. The president of the league, Javier Tebas, was complaining the other day that he'd been unable to reach a kind of a blanket agreement with the AFE, the Spanish equivalent of the PFA. And so it's down now to individual clubs to come up with agreements with their playing staff, or in some cases not come up with agreements, because the Spanish system, which is probably worth stressing this, is not the same as the furlough system, but the Spanish governmental system that allows clubs to apply pay cuts during the state of alarm allows them to do that unilaterally. That's what's known as an ERTE, and a lot of clubs have unilaterally applied these, rather. Some clubs have come up with agreements instead. So where, for example, Barcelona's was a unilaterally applied ERTE, a 70% pay cut for all the players, on top of which the players put an extra 2% to make sure the normal staff, for want of a better word, continue to be paid at 100%. In Real Madrid's case, this is an agreed pay cut for the year's salary of between 10 and 20% on all of the sporting staffs. That means the footballers and the basketball players. It means the players and the coaches. And it also means some of the executives in the various departments of the club. So that normal staff, again, for want of a better word, but then what normal is probably not the right word, but so that normal staff can continue to be paid as they usually would be.
And Tarek, in Germany, players and clubs negotiated directly. And the biggest clubs have reduced salaries by 20 to 30%, smaller ones at 10%. Has everyone done that?
Yeah, it seemed like a much smoother path that didn't need as many headlines we've seen in the UK. And it happened pretty quickly. According to the CEO, Kristen Stiefel, he said he'd spoken to all the clubs and they'd all, both divisions, first and second. And yeah, depending on the size of the club, big ones, 20 to 30, smaller ones, 10%. And there wasn't a massive debate or a massive argument between the two sides to get it done. It just got done. There seems to be a bit more trust, a sort of a collective sense of we need to do something because we're in potential dire straits here. So let's just get this in order as quickly as possible.
Do MPs in Spain talk about footballers being overpaid and expecting them to contribute in this crisis?
I don't think we've seen anything quite like in the UK. Right? So there hasn't been a Matt Hancock figure saying that footballers have to play their part. There hasn't been, I think, a huge moral debate about their role in this. Although it is true, obviously, look, you know, within the sports media, that it gets talked about a little bit, but it doesn't feel like it's had the edge that it's had in the UK. It certainly hasn't drawn players, except in Messi's case when he was directly attacking the Barcelona board who were trying to put pressure on the players to take take a pay cut. We haven't seen that kind of broad sense of, hang on, why are you singling out footballers? Now, of course, people point out that they make a lot of money. And there's this a comment from a biologist, I think it is, in Spain, who'd been asked why it wasn't quick, why she wasn't quicker, or why her industry wasn't quicker in finding cures for the coronavirus. And she said, well, we're on 1,800 euros a month. Why don't you ask Cristiano Ronaldo, who's on X amount, to come up with a solution? But it hasn't really had that thrust in the UK. No, it's been nowhere near as, I don't know, as edgy, I guess, for want of a better word.
Let's talk about potential return dates. Tarek, Christian Seifert, Bundesliga chief executive, saying plans are in place for games to return at all 36 stadiums in the top two divisions by the beginning of May. Hansi Flick says Bayern could be ready to play as soon as the beginning of next month. It seems soon to me.
And to me as well. But, you know, we're talking here in the UK with within our own context, and we're seeing what's happening here in London. And the interesting thing about Germany is that they've been able to, again, I'm no scientist, but they've been doing a lot more testing than us, and their hospitals seem to not be as overwhelmed. They've had the fifth largest number of positive cases, but they've tested so much more as well. And that awful number, the death rate, is among the lowest, if not the lowest, in the world in Germany. And he also told me that all 36 teams are training to varying degrees. So players are on the practice field somewhere in small groups. The numbers are determined by what part of Germany they live in. They think they've got a program to start without supporters from early May. Whether they're able to pull that off will be interesting. And then I guess there's a kind of a moral question as well, whether it's okay for these games to be playing while you know, people are still under heavy restrictions, even in Germany.
And what about in Spain? Because they're not training yet, Sid, but yet Javier Tebas is saying La Liga could resume as early as the 28th of May.
Yeah, he's put forward three potential dates at the moment, the three contingency plans they're working towards. One would be the 28th of May. The other, I think, is the 6th of June. And the final one is the 28th of June. And all of those have different scenarios in terms of whether they work in parallel with European competitions or whether it is the domestic league gets done and then European competitions get put at the end. In fairness to Tebas, and I must say, I don't think it's very helpful that it feels like every day we get a new date put out. And I'm not sure that helps anyone, because those dates, of course, those targets don't get met, and it actually makes the situation feel worse. But they're obliged to come up with potential solutions. They're obliged to come up with potential dates, and those are ones they're coming up with. And as I say, in fairness to Tebas and to the La Liga, what they are saying is that, look, all of this depends on what the health authorities tell us. You know, all of this is based on certain assumptions about when we come back. And if we get to the point in which these dates can't be met, then we'll consider other options. And he said the other day in a conference call that, you know, we're not even contemplating the possibility that the season doesn't get finished. And yet, in a way, they are, because he said, we will contemplate that if we get to the point at which it seems necessary.
When these guys are saying we will be ready to play, does that mean, should the health authorities say we can play, the players will be fit and ready? Or are they saying this is when we want to play, depending on whether we're allowed or not?
From what Christian Seifert was saying, it's going to be directed by the health authorities. And he seemed to suggest, again, I'm not an expert in German football or German politics, but he seemed to suggest that the DFL, which runs the Bundesliga, has developed a really good relationship with the politicians in Germany, and they're kind of working on this together. It's not in isolation. And yeah, when they say go, they're going to be ready to go and play the games from May. The players, as we've seen, you know, we're early April now. What are we? The 9th of April, and they are training and getting their fitness up. So if we're saying another month from now, presumably he's saying that they will be fit enough to resume playing football. I don't know, you know, you're still going to be quite rusty if you haven't actually played in a match. And also you're going to have that backdrop week after week, game after game, playing without supporters. That's also going to perhaps have a big impact on what we're going to see on the pitch.
We had some closed doors games, didn't we, before the lockdown across Europe. But finding a way to use only, I think, is it 239 people in a stadium as a sort of absolute, that is the minimum number of people you need for a football match to take place.
Yeah, he said, it's about 240 is the number he said. But yeah, he included journalists in that as well. So I assume they're camera operators and commentators, perhaps, rather than scribes. And then the physios and all the attendant ancillary people needed to run a game. That's 240 people in each football stadium, wherever a game's taking place, and they will all have to go through the hygiene processes, perhaps be tested as well. I mean, this is quite complicated. They're going to have to sort of nail this down. So there's also a uniform environment at each of the matches, because this whole thing is about we need to show that there's integrity in the competition and all the rest of it.
And what happens if someone gets it?
I asked about that. And it's obviously not a daft question as well, right? Because it's extremely possible. We're living in a pandemic scenario. He suggested that they're going to develop a quarantine protocol. But then, again, into the integrity issue, you normally have footballers, is out with a hamstring, is out with a, an ankle, or sometimes they fall ill. But, he's in quarantine for 14 days. You lose your main striker for 14 days of quarantine. And then you're relegated, or you miss Champions League place. So this is going to be hard. But I think the only options are hard, or very hard, or very, very hard. And this is what they've alighted on to get this done. Because, sad to say, and it's obvious as well, a lot of this is about money. Like all the other leagues in the world, they're on the hook for, if this season isn't finished, 750 million. You could say, so what? But that would also mean the clubs that these supporters are fans of, they're going to find themselves in serious financial problems, probably bankruptcy proceedings. He said if the league isn't finished, 50% of the second division would face a bankruptcy situation. And then you're relying on the goodwill of your creditors, the TV companies, and also the football players. They are the biggest cost base for any football club. So are they willing to not take their salaries to a level that alleviates this? Perhaps is another debate. But these games are being played because it's almost to save whatever the Bundesliga is, or the Premier League, or La Liga.
And is that the same, Sid, in terms of club survival? People worried here about lower league clubs, or actually even sort of smaller Premier League clubs going out of business. What's the state of play in Spain?
Yeah, no, that is exactly it. And as Tarek's saying about Germany, and Tebas said the other day that he had three different scenarios in terms of the financial impact. He said a season that doesn't get finished, €1 billion. A season that gets finished but behind closed doors, €350 million. And a season that can go back and with fans, €150 million in terms of how much they lose. And so he's saying this is about the survival of the game. This is about the survival of clubs. And so as Tarek says, it jars horribly to talk about this. It jars horribly in the middle of a health crisis. But as Tebas keeps saying, my duty beyond the health issue is to maintain the survival of the league. Now, whether he is right in terms of the measures he's putting in place, whether he's right in terms of the dramatic figures that he's putting forward, that is fundamentally the role now. And this is why, as Tarek rightly says, because you can protect the TV rights, which are responsible for around about 70% of the income at most clubs in Spain, at some clubs even more than that, in fact significantly more than that. You can protect that income if you play the games, even if it is behind closed doors. So no one now doubts that if and when football comes back, it comes back without fans, at least to begin with.
The division of TV money in the UK is quite equal among teams in the Premier League, and that's not the case in Spain, as far as I know, where Barcelona and Real Madrid get the lion's share. Does that mean the other 18 clubs are in far more danger of going out of business than, say, a mid-table Premier League side?
Well, in a way it does, but curiously enough, not quite for that reason. So, for example, what's happening is, and you're right, that the division is unequal, although it's more equal than it used to be since the collective deal, which came in place, 4 years ago, I think. But what's really, really significant is that the balance of how much of your income comes from TV is absolutely gigantic for the smaller clubs in Spain. So a club like Eibar or a club like Leganés depends really, really heavily on that TV money, which is why at the moment those clubs are actually in a better place than Barcelona, because Barcelona have been hit very hard by the closure of the museum, by the closure of their club shops. So they haven't had all that marketing money and all that match day going money. But so far, everyone is assuming that they're keeping the TV money, and they've had 90% of it already. The problem is that they might have to pay some back. So those smaller clubs so far haven't been hit. But yeah, the moment at which that TV money drops out, they're the ones that are going to be hurt the most.
Has 51-49 ownership in Germany helped or hindered this crisis, or made no difference at all?
Well, it's too early to tell on that, but there's always been, certainly within some of the clubs, there's been people looking for an opportunity to try and get rid of that model, which is where no single investor can own more than 49%. The club remains an association, as it were. And they're seeing this as a kind of cash flow situation, which if they were able to kind of unpick that regulation, you can have this money flooding in. You know, some German club executives have been looking, you know, perhaps worryingly, enviously at leagues such as ours, where money, doesn't matter whose money it is, comes pouring in, and football has this kind of mega bucket to chuck money at players and wages and build this Uber League. The idea that Bundesliga isn't what it should be because it isn't able to attract, you know, a sheikh or a oligarch or whatever, or a, you know, a new Chinese magnate, because of this. Only if it could, the Bundesliga will be able to go toe to toe with the Premier League. And, you know, it's sad, but this is the sense that they have about what's happening with the Premier League running away, really, from all of the other leagues. It will include La Liga with a couple of exceptions. The amount of money in the Premier League is at a level where it's kind of strange that the English teams actually don't win every European competition, and you know, as well as all domestic honours, a few. And this is the worry of the Bundesliga. You know, they think to uncoil this 51% regulation.
I thought what Seifert said about transfers was really interesting. He said, well, in the short term, I'd say the transfer market this summer will not exist. It will collapse. Some agents will suddenly understand that they will have to work hard, or at least work. Some leagues will understand that money is nothing, that it is coming automatically every month from heaven.
Yeah, all of the, you realise through this crisis how interconnected, like, every little... You saw that thing with, you know, like one of those mechanisms where the ball moves from here and touches that thing and the other thing spins around and then ends up somewhere else. And you realise through this crisis how interconnected, like, all these various leagues are, all the associations are, all the, you know, the TV companies with football, the sponsors, etc. And then into that, right at the heart of it, the middle of this, are the players in two ways: the transfer system, 7 billion swilling around every year, and then the massive pay packets as well. Are probably, you know, in England, that's 59% of all revenue in the Premier League goes to the players and wages. And I would have thought a lot of the remainder is chucked into the summer transfer market and the winter transfer market. And there's three big things that he was alluding to. One, there's a massive cash flow problem. So that's seized up. And the second one, which I find really interesting, is fear. This is kind of a black swan event, as it were. No one, if we were sitting here in January, you'd be doing a normal podcast and there'd be football matches going on. You'd be talking about them and I probably wouldn't be on your show. instead, we're talking about this catastrophic potential collapse of the football industry, and this has happened. And you realise how on the margin, week to week, month to month, these clubs are, because all this money coming in is spat right out, and they have literally, a lot of them, even the big ones, have got no cash flow. And in terms of panic and the transfer market, what if this happens again? Because there is no known cure for this. No vaccine yet, and there's talk about what happens if we have to stop again. Are you going to have this horrible negotiation with football players again? Are you going to stump £50 million in a player who you can't pay the instalments for? So there is a real knock-on effect, and it'll be a brave person that's going to, you know, go into the transfer market and bet the farm on a footballer now and pay them huge money.
Yeah, to pick up on that, is something that Tebas said on Monday, which I thought was very interesting and fits in with all of this. And he was asked whether actually what football needs now is a relaxation of financial fair play rules, because what you need is a sudden inflow of cash from outside the game that enables football to remain buoyant. And he argued the opposite, and he said that you can't allow a relaxation of financial fair play because the fundamental thing, and this goes to what Tarek's saying about the cash flow and about the fact that everyone is waiting on the next pay and the whole thing circulates, and as soon as one of those links has gone, the whole thing collapses. He said, because if you look at Spanish clubs, he said, at the moment, we have, I think he said, I can't remember, and Tarek, you may remember, I think he said, we have €350 million worth of money due to come in. He says, well, what happens if that €350 million worth of money doesn't come in because we relax financial fair play, because we allow clubs to not pay their debt straight away? So that doesn't come into us. We then can't pay the next guy who's relying on the money from us, who can't pay the next guy. And he talks about a domino effect as being something that could happen really, really quickly. Because as soon as you take one of these links out of the chain, the whole thing collapses. And if one goes, they're all going to go down. Now, obviously, it won't be all of them, but it does ask all sorts of questions about how you keep this afloat. And as I say, that was his answer to why you can't just say, all right, let's relax financial fair play and hope that we get a whole load of external capital to come in and keep this up. Because what that will do is it will go hand in hand with a relaxation of other laws, which will prevent us from taking, from receiving the money that we're all relying on. No, that 350 million euros has already been spent. And put in very simple terms, and this is probably the most simple way of looking at this, is that 90% of the TV money in Spain has already been received by the clubs. Like, there's only around about 10% still to be received. And yet we've still got, what is it, 25% of the season still to go. That's slightly less than that, 20% of the season still to go. And so that money may have to be returned. Well, that money's already been spent. How do you give back the money that you've no longer got?
And these questions are all going to be related to the Premier League as well. And we will do that in part three, where we begin with the Players Together campaign. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start with the Premier League players then. The 20 Premier League captains have reached agreement on the formation of a charitable fund called Players Together. They've partnered with NHS Charities Together, the official charity partner of the NHS, quote, in order to assist them in generating and distributing funds quickly and efficiently to where they are needed most. Each captain held conference calls with their individual squads to come up with a system that works best for everyone. They're hoping to raise in excess of 4 million. The fund's going to be administered by Jordan Henderson, Harry Maguire, Troy Deeney, and Mark Noble, and it is separate to any other club and league conversations. I don't know about you, Barry. When I sort of clicked on that hashtag and looked at all the players who'd tweeted it out, I found it strangely moving in a way.
Yeah, it's a nice gesture, and it's important to point out that this was not done as a reaction to what Matt Hancock said last Friday, I think it was, where he pointed out that nurses and doctors were dying from coronavirus and therefore Premier League footballers should, you know, make a contribution, take pay cuts to help the cause, which was a pretty scurrilous thing for him to say. This had apparently been in the pipe for some time before that, and news of it came out last night. So hats off to the footballers. I was just doing the sums, actually. So they're hoping to raise 4 million, and if you there's probably, what, about 500 Premier League footballers. So that's about 10 grand each, which is a sizable chunk of change for anyone. But I would imagine people will complain that it's not enough, because any charitable act that's flagged up on social media, particularly a charitable act done by a famous person or a rich person, is invariably greeted with a lot of praise, but also a lot of sniping. So I've already sort of made a little list of people reacting to this Players Together hashtag. And it's we have people claiming it's just a PR job, people claiming it's a tax dodge, people who almost certainly haven't thrown a fiver into the pot claiming it's just the equivalent of them throwing a fiver into the pot. People pointing out that there's no mention of any particular sum in the statement. People complaining that ungrateful foreign players want to contribute to charities in their own homes, countries rather than in the UK. And people arguing over why Jordan Henderson seems to be getting more credit than the captain of their team. So basically, footballers cannot do right for doing wrong. And no matter what they do, they're going to ship criticism. But it is a good gesture. It's two fingers up to Matt Hancock, and it would be nice to think he'll now urge hedge fund people and his Tory party donors to put their hands in their pockets, but obviously that won't happen. And he's already reacted to their act of generosity with a tweet that kind of suggests he thinks it was down to him.
From the beginning of this, I've been really confused, to be honest with you, because there's the charity part, and we could all do our bit. Footballers should do their bit. If they want to give to the NHS, it's really generous of them. That's fantastic. And if you do or I do, let's just, that's important. And I guess the Matt Hancock thing pushed this all into the public domain, and they were going to do this anyway. But I'd just like to park that a little bit, because when the clubs and the players first started talking, the NHS or public giving or any of that wasn't really a part of this conversation at all. It was an employer who has this cash flow shortage, and then we can argue that they got rich billionaire owners and all the rest of it. But within the bubble of the business of a football club, not who owns them or anything like that, there was a sudden cash flow issue, and they needed their biggest outflow is player salaries. I think Leicester, Bournemouth, Everton, 80% of everything that comes in is paid out in salaries. So that is an immediate issue that needed to be sort of dealt with. Perhaps a deferral first, where that doesn't mean a pay cut, that just means, can we just stop this now? And then maybe if we have some losses, we can share the pain. That to me seems like a sensible thing, but that's not what happened. And we kind of ended up in the mire. We ended up with mudslinging. We ended up with the NHS suddenly being dragged into this story, which the NHS had no place in this. And this is something else. It's a very British thing where we got to drag the NHS into kind of every single type of debate going. And the footballers were pilloried, which is what always happens as well. The other important thing is footballers aren't like other employees in many ways as well, because they're also this kind of asset. So you imagine a football player with a price tag on his lapel. And if they furlough them, or if they cut their pay in order to save the business, they couldn't, because these players could leave on a free transfer. Every single player, if they don't agree to any type of cut, if any even a penny is taken off them without them agreeing to this, they can walk away. So you can imagine, you know, you see these new analysts coming up valuing Manchester United squad at £1.5 billion or whoever else. This is a really kind of tricky negotiation. The players do have a degree of power. And I think that there needed to be a kind of healthier conversation between two. And just lastly, I think there just seems to be a total lack of trust between all parties. That's what this is exposed to. The players not like the clubs. The owners don't trust the players. And then you add Gordon Taylor, the PFA, and it's a total mess.
I think it's also stressed quite well, isn't it? Or expressed quite well by Tony Kroos. I don't know if you saw Tony Kroos's comment the other day where he said, look, one of the things about taking a pay cut is he said that in a way it's effectively like a loan to nothing. It's like you're loaning, you're giving your money away. It's a donation. You're giving your money away, but you don't know where to. You know, it's going into a black hole or it's going to the clubs. And he said, and so I think a more effective way of doing this is for us to maintain our salaries, and then we decide what to do with that money. And that money has to be given somewhere, but it has to be given somewhere where it's needed, and there are plenty of places that need it. Now, of course, the problem with that is if you start deciding everyone decides where their money goes, then I suppose in a way you're arguing for a state system where there's no taxation, where everyone chooses what their money goes on. But of course, but within a private enterprise, which is a football club, Tony Kroos's kind of discussion of, okay, but who decides where this money goes, speaks exactly to what Tarek's saying about that lack of trust. And we saw that with Barcelona's players when they were discussing with the club about the pay cuts. Barcelona's players were actually saying, but hang on, if you take a load of money off us now, and then in the summer you go and spend 150 million euros on a player, well, hang on, we don't really want our money to go towards that. You're telling us that the situation is grave, the situation is very serious, that we need to prop the industry up, prop the business up so it doesn't go out of business. But then that marries very, very uncomfortably with then a transfer market, which I think we now won't see, where all that money gets splurged away again. And this leads me to the other thing, which is that one of the things that I think's most impressive about this Players Together thing is it feels like it's been thought through. It feels like it's got structure. It's got an idea. The fact that they've chosen the charity that they've chosen, that they've chosen a mechanism that they've chosen. This isn't them just saying, here, have some money, Mr. Charity. It's them saying, no, we're going to go through the charity that we think directly reaches that part of, you know, of, I don't know whether to call it industry, it's not industry, that part of society, and in this case, the NHS, that needs it. And so I think the best bit about this for me is the fact that this doesn't look like players just throwing money out. It looks like players thinking through a mechanism that can actually work and that can genuinely have a tangible benefit.
Liverpool, since we last did a pod, have reversed their decision to furlough staff, apologised for their error, will now pay them in full. Chief Executive Peter Moore said in a statement, "We believe we came to the wrong conclusion last week to announce that we intended to apply to the coronavirus retention scheme and furlough staff due to the suspension of the Premier League football calendar, and we are truly sorry for that. The Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust have urged their club to follow Liverpool's lead, tweeting, "We're now saying it clearly and in public. Do not further damage the club's reputation. Listen to your fans." They actually sent out a really measured statement as well, asking for an explanation, saying, "Look, if you're going to do this, you really need to explain why you have to do this." Tottenham keeping in the headlines. A few members of the first team squad were pictured training together on Hadley Common in Barnet. And Ndombele, Sanchez, Sessegnon, Serge Aurier, Juan Foyth, spotted by someone on Twitter, jogging together, being led in a session by Jose Mourinho, who said, "I accept that my actions were not in line with government protocol. We must only have contact with members of our own household." It's mad. Why are they doing it on a public common in Barnet? It's just sort of mind-blowing, isn't it?
Well, they're doing it at a public common in Barnet wearing club training gear. it's not like anyone isn't going to recognise them. And then Jose Mourinho was quite disingenuous when first pulled up about it. He claimed that they had maintained social distancing when there was photographic evidence that proved that was not the case. I think, to be fair, Serge Aurier and Juan Foyth weren't in that group. They were training separately and, you know, sort of a couple of miles down the road in their respective exercise areas. So, and Spurs obviously had a go at Mourinho and I think probably forced him to make this apology. The fact of the matter is, you have to do very, very little to impress football fans. So for Spurs to come out of this just looking hideously bad, it's quite an achievement, you have to say. And I mean Liverpool too, because let's not fool ourselves. The only reason they did that U-turn was because they weighed up the bad PR they were getting and realised that it was going to cost them a lot more than the money they were saving by trying to put their staff on furlough.
This is from Ahmed, who says, "How about some positive news about Chelsea? Open 2 hotels for NHS staff to use for free. Opening their corporate restaurant to feed NHS staff for free. Started a fundraiser to help Refuge for domestic violence victims and will match the amount raised over the next 6 weeks." Yeah, well done to them. Now, some football administrative news over the Russia and the Qatar World Cups. US prosecutors have alleged that FIFA executive committee members were paid bribes to gain their votes for Qatar to host 2022, including Nicolas Leos, former president of CONMEBOL, and the former president of the Brazilian FA, Ricardo Teixeira. Qatar's Supreme Committee responded by saying that it maintains that it strictly adhered to all rules and regulations for the 2018-2022 FIFA World Cup bidding process, and any claim to the contrary is baseless and will be fiercely contested. Tarek, any thoughts?
Trip down corruption memory lane, those names. Hey? I thought we'd seen the last of them for a while. There we go, Teixeira, Grondona, Leos. Two of them are dead. Teixeira is awaiting extradition, he's not going to be extradited from Brazil. They don't have a relationship, so he said he's denied all of this, as you probably would. And then we had Uncle Jack. Jack Warner was appeared in connection with the Russian case. That was the most interesting one because it had so much detail about various wire transfers, like 15 different shell companies, 9 different countries, just to get a bit of cash over to Jack Warner, about $5 million. And then the Russians, as they have done always, if you think about it, deny that any wrongdoing over anything. This reminds me of the massive state-sponsored doping program that, as far as Russia are concerned, still didn't happen. So we are where we were. But what's really interesting is it's in a United States government document now. So whenever we cover the Qatar World Cup, we can say without threats of all sorts of things that, according to the United States, this is a World Cup which was chosen by people who were bribed. So that kind of adds a different backdrop to it, rather than just talking about it in the pub with your mates.
Elsewhere, Jimmy Greaves is awaiting test results after being admitted to hospital on Tuesday. His hospitalisation is not related to COVID-19. He turned 80 in February, suffered a severe stroke, you'll remember, in 2015. His official Facebook page has been posting updates, the most recent one yesterday lunchtime, which says, "All I can say is no news is good news at the moment. Jimmy has spoken to his wife Irene by phone. Watch this space and have a good thought for Jimmy as you go about your current daily routine. Hopefully he won't be in hospital for too long." Worth mentioning that documentary that BT Sport did, go and find it. It's an absolutely brilliant, nostalgic journey and just shows what an amazing footballer he was. Some sad news from Barcelona. It was reported that Pep Guardiola's mum died after contracting COVID-19, and football lost a name this week in Radomir Antic, Luton Town legend, the only person to have managed Real Madrid, Atletico and Barcelona, died at the age of 71. He'd struggled for several years with pancreatitis, ended his playing career at Luton Town. Luton fans absolutely love him. Joined in 1980, scoring the winning goal 4 minutes from time in their game against Man City on the final day of the 82-83 season, keeping Luton up in the first division and relegating City. Is that the David Pleat dancing down the pitch?
That's exactly it, yeah.
Sid, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Antic is very popular in Spain, as you say, the only person to have coached Madrid, Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. At Barcelona, he came in a time of crisis and kind of settled them, but that was in 2003. So at the end of the year, there were presidential elections and he didn't continue. At Real Madrid, he's famous because he was sacked 19 games into the season with the team 7 points clear at the top of the table. The football was not exciting enough, according to the president. Of course, Real Madrid then didn't win the league, which is a kind of a bit of justice for you. And as Atletico Madrid manager, he won the League and Cup double in 1996, and I think it's, in terms of the, if you like, the kind of the popular image of Atletico Madrid, it's impossible to fully express just how huge that was. He was a guy who absolutely loved talking about football, a real talker, spoke in that way that a lot of people in the Balkans do, that they never use the article. So instead of the game was very good, it would be game very good, and that became kind of characteristic of the way that he spoke, and I think his impact, certainly Atletico, was absolutely gigantic.
This question from Jonathan Wilson. Does Tarek regret that night in Johannesburg in 2009? Not the Gerard Houllier night, the Trevor Stephen incident and what followed. And what exactly was the story in Ukraine when a taxi driver took him to collect a puppy?
I have no recollection of what happened in Johannesburg, so we'll just talk about the puppy. It wasn't actually a puppy. It was a kitten.
Right.
I was driving in Ukraine with Igor, who... we had one word that we could both be, you know, could be understood. Hello. And we were driving for miles between these stadiums. And suddenly the cab comes to a screeching halt in the middle of nowhere. Bullet-headed Igor, big man, gets out of the cab. I was thinking, you know, what, I have no idea what's happening here. He scurries along the side road, appears back with two kittens, places them in the car, one on my lap, and we just carry on driving. I still don't know exactly what happened, but we Igor and two kittens, I waved them off, I think, close to the Kiev Stadium. So that's that one.
Tor Jensen says, I'm dying to get a fresh update about Archie Rintutt's love life. If you remember, the last time he was on, he was discussing a Tinder date and his piano lessons. Please enlighten us with good news from Germany in these dire times. Archie replied to me saying, you may say piano is going well. I've been learning Trouble by Taylor Swift. Titley87 says, Max, just wanted to say your Asterix joke was criminally underappreciated by the rest. Lots of people said this, and shame on you, Barry. Astonishing from such, I presume, well-read members of our society.
I still don't get it.
You said they need to put an asterisk by France winning this World Cup.
Yeah.
And I said, if you're going to put an asterisk next to any one winning a World Cup, it should be France, because
asterisk and obelisk, yeah,
like where all jokes are explained, they don't seem as funny. But at the time, trust me, Sid and Tarek, it was a moment of total gold. Now, next week's watch along, we are going to do Brazil Italy from the second round of the 1982 World Cup, one of the best games of all time. Apparently, I've never seen this football match. I've heard of it. Barney Ronay's favourite game. He's written a piece about it for the paper, and he will join us on Monday's pod. Looking forward to that, Baz?
Yes, indeed. I'm particularly looking forward to a watch-along with Barney and his waspish, withering asides and contemptuous worldview. I haven't spoken to Barney since lockdown started. I suspect he's probably not coping with it very well.
I put out a poll for which chapter we're going to do for Detective Wilson. I presume that will finish at some point. It may even have finished. Will Knight, thank you for saying, I think Detective Wilson, the only thing sustaining me right now. And Jim saying, read Detective Wilson, let's go into the Ligue 1 loan market purely so we can have Philippe Auclair moodily smoking a gitane with a Trilby's brim pulled down low over his face, probably skulking in the shadows somewhere, providing Columbo-esque insight at the last moment. And an email from Joe. The subject was bored in quarantine, so I'll be a true American and complain. It does involve a compliment, this, so I'd like to apologise in advance. Hi, guys. You've given background on yourselves. We did This Is Your Life with Sid. People liked it, Sid.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
We did one with Philippe. We're going to do more. Here is some on me, says Joe. I started listening while at college in 2012. I would listen to the big stories at the start and use the rest as white noise to fall asleep. I then quickly realised I actually enjoyed the pod, Jim, Barry and Sid becoming immediate favourites. Now you've killed two of my heroes. First I realised I like this Max guy better than Jim. And now as a Manchester United fan, I could realise I can no longer support Scouser Sid's work. Don't ruin Barry's reputation, please. He is all I have left.
And where was the compliment there?
Yeah, which compliment was this?
Anyway, that'll all do for today's pod. Tarek, thank you so much for coming on.
Good to be with you guys.
May you and your New York Times friends go well. Sid Lowe, cheers, pal.
See you soon.
Sid sent me his PhD. I asked for it just because it would be funny if I read Sid's PhD before I read Inverting the Pyramid. So I'm definitely going to do that now. Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
And finally, it is time for Barry's lyrics. If you don't like them, it's a good time to go. Phil says, grounds for legal action, Max and Barry. After Clive Tilsley has started reading lyrics on Instagram, Hugh Bonneville has been caught reading the lyrics to Love Machine by Girls Aloud. it's what happens in lockdown. So to finish today's pod, it is Barry Glendenning with his version of Coolio's Gangster's Paradise.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's not much left, because I've been blasting and laughing so long that even my mama thinks my mind is gone. But I ain't never crossed a man that didn't deserve it. Me be treated like a punk, you know that's unheard of. You better watch how you're talking and where you're walking, or you and your homies might be lined in chalk. I really hate to trip, but I got a lock. As I grow, I see myself in the pistol smoke, fool. I'm the kind of G the little homies want to be like, on my knees in the night, saying prayers in the streetlight. Been spending most their lives living in the gangster's paradise. Been spending most their lives living in the gangster's paradise. Keep spending most our lives living in the gangster's paradise. Keep spending most our lives living in the gangster's paradise.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.